But check this out. The Department of Defense is creating a copy of all of us in an alternate reality, well, a virtual reality, to find out how long you can go without food or water or how you will respond to televised propaganda, writes the Register. It turns out that the DOD is developing a massive, what they call a sentient world simulation. They're creating a massive PSYOP simulator in a complex computer system to simulate the decisions of every sentient being on the planet. They're actually going to populate it with, you know, 7 billion little sentient programs or whatever the actual number is, to find out how you're going to react to their psychological operations. So then they're going to test in the simulation what would happen if they did a false flag attack, for example. How would you react? They're going to test what would happen if they dumped more fluoride into the water and dumbed everybody down a little more. They're going to test probably chemtrail attacks, biological weapons, rolling out more liberal propaganda, like making you think the family is bad and that the only people that should have rights are undocumented immigrants or people who are not heterosexual, gays, or, you know, just they're going to test every possible agenda they can think of in this simulator. So that's just the start of the kind of news that we're going to get into today. This simulator, the sentient world simulator, replicates financial institutions, media outlets, and even street corner shops. It applies theories of economics and human psychology, and its developers believe they can predict how individuals and mobs will respond to various stressors. Well, isn't that just delightful? So now we're going to have a PSYOP.
Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording from the flatlands of Flanders on the 2nd of July, 2013. This would be the second installment listed under Nav Briefing 73, which has the generic title, Where the Nightmare Ends. And the title of this specific briefing is Game Over for Anthropos 10. So what you heard there in that little introductory run-in was the intrepid Health Ranger, Mike Adams, a pretty interesting guy, a pretty straight guy, and his natural news bulletins can be helpful and instructive if you haven't picked up on them. Mike is sitting in, of course, for Alex Jones on the Alex Jones Show. In case you don't know what the Alex Jones Show is, it is a Project Mockingbird / COINTELPRO platform for establishing the controlled opposition in the upcoming civil war in the United States. And I find it completely intolerable to listen to Alex Jones anymore. Alex Jones has pretty much blown his load, if I might use a vulgar American expression, and has become an intolerable blowhard who never shuts up and never lets the occasionally interesting people he has on his show say what they have to say. Lately, Alex Jones has been ranting a lot about the danger that he is in as a great American hero, thus he portrays himself, and suggesting that he's going to be killed, which is total bullshit. And even if he was killed, that would also be bullshit. So what I have to say to Alex Jones, if you're listening, Alex, is that you are a chump, and on top of it, you're a Christian. And there is no future for Christianity, either in the United States or in any other country of this planet. So you're being set up, and it's probably better for you if you don't know that. And you probably know that it's better for you that you don't know that. And I don't care what they're setting you up for, because when the Civil War happens in the United States, there will be, yes, a great faction of the opposition to the federal government who fall into the controlled opposition, for which you represent a demagogic leader, dead or alive. But there will also be a significant portion of the population who do not fall into that prefabricated trap. So your whole Christian patriot movement has no future, and neither does your news program unless you seriously start using the Z word and the J word. When those words apply, those words are conspicuously absent from your ongoing self-styled exposé of the globalists. And I know that myself and a good number of other people who watched you through the years and who saw you arrive at the position that you're in now are detecting the glaring omission of those terms in your programs. And of course, you would argue, we are not racist. I heard that recently on your program. Well, there's nothing racist about calling the behavior of certain people for what it is. Also, I want to say, as a final comment, dear Mr. Jones, that I consider the word Nazi to be a racist slur against the German people. And if you continue to use the word Nazi by saying, for example, the American government is as bad as the Nazis, and it's becoming like a Nazi Gestapo police state in the United States, if you continue to talk like that, then I assure you that when the great lie of the Nazi German menace breaks and the truth comes out, and when the Holocaust legend disintegrates at the seam, you will lose credibility faster than you can count the chickens running across the road. So that's my friendly warning to Alex Jones. Now I will proceed as usual in my role of navigator with Nav Briefing number 73, installment 2. It may seem like a grim title, Game Over for Anthropos, but I have to tell you, I'm beginning to think it's something to celebrate. First of all, it's laughable. Listen to what Mike Adams said at the beginning of this briefing. How much further can it go? Do you think that this sentient simulation program will actually work? Who is going to apply this program? Who's going to run this program? Are they going to have simulated people running the simulations to test the simulations that they foist on the public, which itself has become a simulation of humanity, lacking all true qualities of the species? Where are they going to go next? Once again, we are facing the consummation of the work of the Archons, and it is at this moment, game over for Anthropos 10, that the power of that magical child, who is the subject of this divine experiment, the creature designed by the Aeon Sophia herself, it is at that moment that that creature, that magical animal of the goddess, comes forward and shows its power. And out of that power is born Anthropos 11. And that is the only thing that can survive on this planet into the next stage of this experiment, the next chapter of this story. Anthropos 11 is the only part of humanity that can and will survive, and it's the only part that is worth preserving. So it's time to celebrate and have a big laugh about the end of Anthropos 10 and to be entertained by what the DOD is doing, and be entertained by the endgame strategies of the Zadokite globalists who want to turn the United States into a Gulag/Palestine extermination camp. That's their nightmare, dream from heaven itself. And let's just sit back and get some popcorn and just watch it happen. Stay clear of the flak if you can, but maybe it's time to be entertained and have a good laugh at how far the human animal can go because she gives it so much slack. Thelete gave us that slack. You can blame Thelete for it, okay? Cognitive latitude. Connative latitude. So Faya gives us cognitive latitude. That is to say, an enormous bandwidth for learning, which includes, of course, the risk of error and learning by trial and error, and the risk that if errors go undetected, they will accumulate and escalate beyond the scale of correction. That is the risk of being magical animals of the wisdom goddess, endowed with the capacity to learn at a genius level and to play with the secrets of nature and of the aeons themselves. That is the risk. Nothing comes without a risk. And on the other side, Thelete gives another aspect of that risk factor, which is cognitive latitude. How far we, the human animal, can go because it is not restricted like other species on this planet by an instinctual program for self-preservation. Now, as I move into this briefing, dancing lightly on my goat feet across the deck of the mothership, I'd like to just touch a few points of allusions I made upon which I did not follow up, which sometimes happens due to, as you know, maintaining the ratio between download and delivery. I've talked about that before. So when the download ratio is maybe 6 to 10, exceeds the delivery ratio, which is maybe 5 to 10, causes me to allude to things that I can't follow up or that get lost in the flow, in the subsequent flow. I mentioned in my first briefing from up here in the north of Europe that I arrived on the 24th of June, and that was a significant day for me. Well, indeed it was. You know, I'm looking here at a printout from metahistory.org. The title of the document, don't ask me where you're going to find it on the site, but the title of the document is Gaia Responds to a Sane Human Witness. And the subtitle is Love and the Supernatural. And I published it in October of 2008, which was the moment, early in October 2008, which was the moment when I actually caught my breath. First time, really, that I was able to catch my breath in the year 2008. From the middle of May onward. I would say from the middle of May 2008 to June, July, August, September, October, for about 5 months, I couldn't catch my breath. Metaphorically speaking, the delirium, the divine mania, as Plato called it, was upon me. And of course, you know, it was in that state of mind that I received the term of Gaia Awakening. What I explained in this article, Gaia Responds to a Sane Human Witness, is how I went up to Infinity Ridge on June 24th, 2008, dutifully thinking that I would fulfill my role as Gaia's first Turton and go ask the Aeon Sophia a question or two and come back and report to the world. Hey, I've got a walk my talk, right? If I claim that I can access the intelligence of the planetary mother, animal mother, and talk with her like I would talk with my girlfriend, then I better demonstrate it. I better demonstrate the claim. And so, you know the story, some of you know, that I went up there on the ridge, and I'll read here a little bit. That day, I rather sheepishly turned to address Sophia, before entering the directed clairaudient trance required to communicate with her in pitch-perfect, full-toned audition. I wasn't sure I could sustain the necessary level of concentration as long as I was mentally and emotionally obsessing about that woman, you know who had abandoned me on April 6th, some 80 days before. But I was not going to apologize to Sophia for being distracted from my sacred practice, because one does not trouble supernatural allies with such matters. So I thought, nevertheless, I could not hide my reservation and conceal my state of obsession from her all-seeing gaze. I turned to the Devi tree to make my usual salutation before entering, or trying to enter, full-tone clairaudient rapport with Gaia. And wham, the cobra struck. Kali hit me like a boxcar coming at 120 miles per hour. I was stunned. I was arrested in mid-thought. And then the Devi delivered her message, phrased in shockingly personal terms, end quote. So I won't read the entire message, but you know that what happened to me on that day was an enormous surprise to me. It was at that day, about 80 days into an initiatory experience directed by my Dakini guardian, Kali Ma, that I actually realized I was in an initiation. And the timing parameters of that initiation became vividly clear to me that afternoon on the ridge. And I understood the initiation would last for 108 days from April 6th, 2008. And at the end of that time, I would have distilled, in some manner or other, the experience that I had undergone in the previous 13 months with that woman who is the notorious heroine of planetary tantra and who couldn't care less. That is not a leading remark, nor is it a hidden plea. Be assured, the fact of her not caring was essential to how the terma of Gaia awakening came to be revealed. I ask you to reflect closely on that point. And so, as I stood there stunned on the ridge on June 24th, 5 years ago, I received the instructions from my guardian concerning the particulars of this initiation. And again, I quote briefly from that posting on metahistory.org. Kali says, "Life sent that woman to you, but I used her for my purposes. Supernaturally. You believed you were going to initiate her into Tantra, but you were deluded. For 13 months, you have been in a tantric initiation in which you made every mistake you could make due to the differences of age and culture between you and her. But what you learned from those mistakes is to be the source of precious, incomparable wisdom that you will impart to the world at large. From your experience of sexual innocence with that woman, you will extract a unique message for Kali Yuga and initiate the return of the goddess. This initiation into Kala Tantra will be the first of its kind, a unique ritual that sets the standard for the 9 generations of those who live in the black time of innocence, the closing 200 years of Kali Yuga. Your initiation has been ongoing since April 6th and will last exactly 108 days. And so it came about that at the end of those 108 days, which was June 21st, 2008, I was in Ronda, Spain, and around 2:42 in the afternoon, there occurred something I call the Ronda moment. And that mystical experience of bliss and beauty was certainly the supreme case of the mystical moments I've lived in my life. No doubt it was so, because it carried in it as a content all the love and beauty of my experience in that. Doomed romance. And also because of the way that Kali directed me through the experience, my own inner guidance, if you will, my own innermost self, you want to call it that, you want to give it that kind of name, give it any name you like, but bear in mind that the powers that move me and that bring me into these mystical experiences and give me such insight and skill as I may have as a mystic and Tertan do not come merely from some inner source or inner light that I hold. They come from the power that I share with the earth, not merely the power that I hold in some spiritual interiority of my soul. And so the power burst forth 108 days after April 6th, when the earth and sun were aligned in the apsides of Jupiter, by the way. Get a big laugh out of that, folks. And then 18 days after the Rhonda moment, on August 8th, 2008, I received the term of Gaia Awakening. I did, however, manage to capture a little bit of intel from the goddess when I was up on the ridge that day. That, as you know, was my mission. And I did not come back entirely empty-handed. I came back with a number of points, a number of insights that I will just reiterate here briefly, namely three. I went up with a question for the goddess. You know, telestic shamanism involves asking a question. The motif of asking a question is a deeply occult theme. I have written about it on metahistory.org in relation to the Celtic goddess material that is the background of the Grail legend. And as you may know, in the Grail legend, which I'm going to return to at the end of this briefing, the naive stumblebum hero who finds the Grail achieves his mission by asking a question, two questions actually. But the question that is recorded in Wolfram von Eschenbach's version of Parzival is, what ails the uncle? Therefore, he is asking that question to the wounded Fisher King. The higher significance of that question can be extrapolated from the particular story, the particular narrative details of the Grail story to the universal dimension. And so the question really is, what ails the humanity? Why do you suffer, humanity? What is killing you, humanity? What is making you ill, humanity? This is the Grail question, a good question to ask to Anthropos 10 as you watch it collapse on its last leg and expire in front of your eyes. Still a good question to ask. And so I asked a question, that is the method of telestic shamanism, and put it directly to the organic light, which is the luminous and living presence of the wisdom goddess within nature, her naked presence, if you will, her naked attention, to be sure. And I said, what path do those human beings need to follow who revere you and observe your ways so that they can survive the coming extinction? That is to say, the game over for Anthropos. 10. And her answer was, you can write the epitaph for humanity. Perished for the failure to observe beauty. Well, that was one thing I picked up on that day, out of the mind of the goddess. She also gifted me with a couple of other insights. She never called it information. It's not information, it's sacred knowledge, it's intel, it's not information. Information belongs to the realm of the archons. Information is neutral. There is no single piece of telestic initiatory knowledge that I have ever offered to you. And no single instruction deriving from the wisdom sphere of the Dakinis that I have ever translated to you that is mere information. None of it is neutral. Sacred intel is not neutral, like information. And so I got two snippets of sacred intel. Well, one was, better find out where your water comes from. That was a nice piece of practical advice from the planetary animal mother. Better know where you get your water if you want to survive through this extinction. And then she made a couple of comments which I couldn't secure properly because my faculties of clairaudient audition, as I explained, were faulty due to my emotional state at that moment and to my obsession. The primary focus of all of my thought and all of my attention was so fixated on this particular woman, my yidam for planetary tantra. Emma was the yidam for planetary tantra. I want you to go and investigate the significance of that statement. Y-I-D-A-M. And my attention was so focused on that yidam and my immersion in the practice of the development and perfection stages of Ati Yoga was so all-consuming that I couldn't give my attention sufficiently to hear what Gaia Sophia was telling me. But I picked up two clues. One of them was about the bees and about the collapse of the bee colonies and something about the bees, something that we need to know. The bees follow the bees to get through the next extinction. I guess that's what she was saying. I guess she was saying that the bees are the secret, which is a really interesting comment, you know, because I have a little theory that I'm going to throw at you here. This is just kind of a footnote, but you might find this palpably interesting. When I was researching the Dendera Zodiac and going deep into Egyptian mythology and Egyptian star wisdom, and when I had the occasion to visit some temples in Egypt, such as those at Philae, the temple of Isis at Philae, which has been removed from its original position to an island due to the flooding of the Aswan Dam, and of course the Dendera temple itself dedicated to Hathor, and then the temple at Edfu, and so forth, I was recurrently struck, as anyone would be, by the looming presence of nautical motifs in Egyptian art. Now, it's true that the Nile is a great river running through the desert, which was, in fact, not a desert for a long period of time. So the Nile Valley was very fertile, and there was a lot of boat traffic on the Nile, obviously. But there's something more to the nautical symbolism and the presence of boats and ships in Egyptian mythology and in the frescoes in these temples. And I understood, for instance, that in one temple, I think it is the Edfu temple, that when you go into the room of the Sanctum Sanctorum, the inner sanctuary, you see around the wall an interesting fresco, which again shows boats with a lot of cargo on them, very specific kinds of cargo, which appears to be, some of it appears to be technical instruments, like medical instruments. And then there is in the middle of this room, which is not a large room, it's maybe 14 feet square, is a cube, and on that cube is an open cube facing you as you come in. And in that open cube, there used to be a model of a boat. Now, these Egyptian boats came from where? Are we talking about boats just going up and down the Nile? Well, possibly. Are we talking about the symbology of the Pharaoh's boat from which he sails to the heavens and blah, blah, blah? Well, yes, but remember the rule of Idris, that detecting and working the power of any symbol requires seeing it in its symbolic and literal sense simultaneously. That's the method of Idris. So I was looking for the literal sense. I understand the symbolism of the boat. We're using the symbolism of the boat for the Gaian navigation experiment, aren't we? But we know that we're actually on that boat, don't we? So I thought, well, where did this all come from? So then I came across a remarkable book by the comparative mythologist Mackenzie, which he explained that the method of wrapping mummies in Polynesia is exactly the same as it is in Egypt, down to the finest detail, down to the way the wrapping is done, which is very methodical and very particular, down to the spices used. And furthermore, there are other extraordinary parallels between Polynesia and Egypt. And I began to develop a kind of scenario, or I would say a scenario began to develop in my mind, sort of in the foggy mists of phylogenetic memory. I said, wait a minute, where did the Egyptians come from? Where did the companions of Horus come from when they arrived at the site of the Dendera temple so many, many thousands of years before the first civilization of Menes? Where did the companions of Horus come from? Did they sail to Africa and then sail up the coast of Egypt, up the coast of Africa until they reached the Gulf and then entered Egypt in that manner? Of course, there's a lot of speculation about these matters, and I don't just want to add to the heaps of speculation and extraneous information, but I will share with you the one striking clue that came to me at that time that I can't get out of my mind. Suppose that Egyptian civilization was founded in part, because to a certain extent, of course, Egyptian civilization came out of the depths of Africa. I mean, I know all about that. I can tell you that story and every character in it. It's no problem. But to what extent was there an external migratory stream that fed into Egypt and contributed to the rise of Egyptian civilization? A migratory stream from a lost civilization that conjoined with those factors that arose out of African shamanism and the worship of the animal powers and the depth and wisdom of the darkness of Africa. That, of course, is the matrix of Egyptian civilization. But what if there was an external factor that was grafted onto that? It has something to do with bees. And the collapse of the civilization in Polynesia that necessitated migrations from there may have been, get this, connected with a disaster that fell upon a certain community of people because they were stung by bees. Anaphylactic shock from bee stings can kill an individual, as you know. Could also kill an entire culture. And yet at the same time, the bee would be held sacred to that culture because it is from an extraction of the chemical that produces anaphylactic shock, that the shock could be prevented from being lethal. In the same principle that you use the toxin of a snake, use an extraction of the venom of a snake against snake bite. So I had this idea about bees. Somehow bees, the secret of bees, goes back into the history of this culpa and is connected with the collapse and rebirth of civilizations. That's it. That's the point I'm getting to. That's what I could not see 5 years ago. That's what she was trying to tell me. Watch the bees. Learn about what happened with the bees. And why does Minoan Crete also celebrate the bee goddess? The bee is a totemic animal of Minoan Crete. Why? Think about the relations between the Minoan Cretans and the Egyptians, who are really equivalent cultures of high aesthetic standard. So that's it. That's the clue. Now I can pick up that clue. Fantastic. Second clue she gave me, I can also pick up. Remember I said that she said, look, your civilization is already in collapse. Don't stand around, drumming your fingers on the table, wondering when it's going to happen. This was 5 years ago. It's already in collapse. It's like a building in free fall, a building collapsing in slow motion. The floors are already dropping everywhere. And she said that she began already to engage the anaerobic systems. I thought, what the fuck does that mean? She's locking on the anaerobic systems. That's the best way that I could translate into English what she told me. I'm locking on the anaerobic systems. I had no idea what she meant at that time, but now, of course, I know exactly what she means. She's talking about methane. She's talking about the cookers under the sea in the anaerobic regions of the ocean. The massive increase of volcanism under the ocean combined with the massive release of methane along the eastern shelf of Siberia and so forth and so forth. And that these are extinction-producing responses of the planetary animal mother. So there you go. I just wanted to pick up those clues. Nothing you learn in the presence of the wisdom goddess is ever extraneous. It's not merely information. It lives in you, and it always bears in some way or other on the vital features of this divine experiment. So yes, the sixth extinction, as the archaeologists and paleontologists call it, is now underway. No big surprise. Get out your popcorn. And as it goes underway, we can actually watch it happen. You got a ringside seat. Watch the sinkholes. Watch the salt domes collapsing. Remember, she integrates her tulpa by a lightning strike off salt banks. Remember that. She integrates the colloidal form of her tulpa. She needs salt because salt is the fixative in any alchemical process, and this is the divine alchemy of the wisdom goddess we're talking about here. You have mercury, sulfur, and salt, don't you? And salt is the fixative she needs to materialize her tulpa. So it's happening, me mates. It's happening as I speak. Now let me just touch a few more niggling details before I continue with the main topic of this briefing. I said once in a conversation, an early conversation on Grok the Talk, that I had been greatly influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche. And of course, everybody knows that because it's written large and not in his image, starting with the introduction. And I believe at that moment, the gentleman with whom I was having that conversation said, well, yeah, did Nietzsche clue you to the mysteries? And I said, no, but of course that's entirely untrue. It just escaped my mind at that moment that in addition to reading Thus Spake Zarathustra when I was 16 or 17, I read The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. In fact, I think it would be fair to say that I went dizzy reading The Birth of Tragedy. And as you may know, if you've ever read it, the main subject of The Birth of Tragedy, as treated by Friedrich Nietzsche, is the contrast between the Apollonian and the Dionysian views of life. And in order to flesh out his argument in favor of the Dionysian view, Nietzsche periodically or continually refers to the Apollonian and the Dionysian mysteries. So I think it would be fair to say that the first place that I ever encountered the term mysteries in relation to the pagan initiatory movement of the Teleste was in The Birth of Tragedy by Friedrich Nietzsche when I was 16 years old. And I was mystified, of course. And I really, wanted to know, well, what is this thing called the mysteries, you see? And also, I'd love to point out, as I recall that wonderful formative moment in my life, that reading The Birth of Tragedy also initiated me into a lifetime study of Greek mythology and what I would call Greek psychology or metapsychology, that is concerning the concept of the human soul or psyche. Does this ring a bell? As understood not merely by the Greek people of ancient times, but also and particularly so by the mysterious community of people involved in these mysteries. And of course, it's known now, and here's again another footnote, that Nietzsche himself was deeply influenced by his friend Erwin Rohde, R-O-D-H-E, who was a sort of comparative mythologist, a cultural mythologist is probably a better term, of the late 19th century. And Erwin Rohde wrote some classical studies of archetypal psychology in ancient Greek myth and legend. And the title of those two volumes by Rohde is Psyche. So psyche, which literally means butterfly and metaphorically means soul, came fluttering into my mind back in my adolescence and landed on my shoulder as I was reading The Birth of Tragedy by Nietzsche. It's funny to encounter a book like that at that age. I must say, I understood very little of it, of course. But I knew that by reading it and reading the words, and I read it repeatedly, that it was nurturing something deeply in the roots of my intelligence that were roots that I couldn't even access at that time, you know. And so all of that matured much, much later. And even today, I am benefiting from the maturity of that encounter, that fortunate encounter. Thank you, Friedrich Nietzsche. And thank you for going insane to demonstrate to the human race the advent of its own insanity. So finally, one small correction I want to make in the same genre. I've often referred to the word conscience. Remember when we were talking about, we were looking at the perigee hits in the scales, I explained that the constellation of the scales is a construction of the Teleste and a rather late constellation, constructed around the time that Socrates lived, and that you find in the writings of Euripides the first use of the term conscience, which is a Greek word, synodesis. And I said that you find that in Euripides' play Medea, but that's not correct. I've said this several times. I've made this mistake about six times. It is found in the Orestes trilogy of Euripides and not in his Medea, as far as I know. It may also be in the Medea, but I do believe that the word synodesis is found for the first time in the Orestes plays of Euripides. Greek tragedy, you know, was inspired by the initiates. It was a popular vehicle, a platform, for the initiates to teach the masses. And hence the meaning of the word tragedy. It comes from the Greek tragos, meaning goat, and odoi, meaning song. So tragedy really means a goat song. And the goats, of course, were the initiates, the telestai. And finally, I'd just like to mention, on the theme of repression and self-oppression, an interesting quote that came up recently from the African activist who was murdered for his beliefs and his actions, Steve Biko. And this quote comes from Richard Grove, who's also been on Alex Jones recently, who has a big platform, you know, anti-authority platform on the internet called tragedyandhope.com. Richard Grove is interesting because he's an individual who would have died in an office meeting on one of the upper floors of the World Trade Center on 9/11 if he hadn't been caught in a traffic jam. That was a real wake-up call for Richard Grove. Anyway, Richard Grove is quoting Steve Biko to say, "The greatest weapon in the hands of an oppressor is the mind of the oppressed." I really like that statement. That's Steve Biko, and I'm sure he knew exactly what he was talking about. So when you contemplate that long Marcuse or Marcusa quotation, and when you take from that quotation the realization that in any kind of self-repression, the human animal is complicit with the worst oppression that can be imposed upon it, then give a thought to Steve Biko. So, at the 45 minute of this talk, we have about half an hour left, and I'd like to come around to the subject of the Grail. Remember that I said that these talks in this series, 73, however many installments I do, maybe three or four, would be also offering a kind of travelogue or maybe some comments and impressions to share with you during my visit up here in Northern Europe. Well, I haven't been out and about much lately. I've been staying up here in the Grenier and minding my onions, as the French say. But it might be appropriate for me to present to you with a little background on this place where I find myself, which is generically or loosely called Flanders, located in the nation state of Belgium, which has only existed since, I think, 1832. Belgium was invented by what some people would call the Illuminati, the Saxe-Coburg family. Does that ring a bell? And so it's no surprise, if that is the case, which it certainly is, that Brussels, which is the center of the European community, which is a huge scam of the Illuminati and the central banking systems of the Western world, it's no surprise that Brussels would be located at the rotten heart of Europe. So I came to the rotten, corrupt heart of Europe by a series of personal connections, destiny connections, and by the hand of fate and by friendships. And by the way, here is a saying of Idris that's been floating in my mind all day, and it just materialized about 20 minutes ago. The fate of friendships disposes any change of fate. I guess that instruction, or paraphrase of instruction, if you will, I wouldn't call it a direct instruction, but certainly it is a message in the mood of the dark, of the shift of Idris. And maybe that comes to mind because I'm recalling that I found my way to Belgium, this funny, homely little country, through friendships which no longer hold. So the coming and going of a friendship, the fate of a friendship, determines, as it were, a kind of fault line along which fate can be changed. Sorcerers and Gayan Tantricas talk a lot about fate. It's a subject for twilight conversations when they huddle in their shawls, sipping champagne because it's cheaper than water, or putting away a bottle of Finca La Estacada. So naturally, when I'm in my tonal point of power in Belgium, I would reflect upon the fate of my friendships. Almost nothing remains of my friendships of the past. Almost nothing. And reflect upon the course of events that led me here by way of friendships that no longer hold. And by way of a little travelogue, like a good tourist guide, let me give you a little historical background information. Now, I know that at least one or two of you may be sick and tired of hearing me talk about Europe. Well, don't worry, I'm going to talk about America soon, and that's going to really fry your potatoes. But for right now, just indulge me for a moment, because you know I do love this country. I don't care much for Europeans. In fact, I only have one really close European friend of long duration. That means of more than 15 years. Okay. There's a legend, the details of which escape me. But there is a legend that says that sometime in the 12th century, or the beginning of the 13th century, that is 1200 AD, the time when Wolfram von Eschenbach was writing Parzival, that the Grail came to Bruges in Flanders. That is the legend. It is probably a legend that comes out of some French language chronicles deriving from the Christianized versions of the Grail legend that were initiated by Robert de Boron and Chrétien de Troyes. Okay. The details of all this and the material scholarship behind it are rather sketchy to me, so just bear with me, I'm going to glide through it. In the legend that says that the Grail came to Bruges in Flanders in the 12th century, the object in question is generally understood to be a relic. That is to say, a chalice. Now, in the Christian versions of the Grail is a chalice or cup because it was identified first by Robert de Boron, a Grail romancier. It was identified with the chalice that was used at the Last Supper and subsequently used by Joseph of Arimathea to collect the blood gushing from the side of Christ on Golgotha. All of that is a fabricated, retrofitted Christian legend introduced at the beginning of the 12th century in order to hijack and appropriate the true meaning of the Grail story, which is the greatest guiding story, the greatest guiding narrative of a historical and cultural kind of Western civilization. The guiding narrative of the Sophianic mythos is for the entire planet, and its derivation is through the channel of the Levantine Teleste. But the Grail legend, which is pre-Christian and pagan, is, as Joseph Campbell said, the paramount secular narrative that guides civilization and guides human development in the Western world. Europe and America included, in South America, you can throw it in for the bargain. Even throw in Canada if you want to. Okay. But when that legend was appropriated and co-opted, as the term goes, hijacked, to use the other term, by Christians, the Grail came to be identified with that chalice, and therefore the whole meaning of the Grail story was diverted back into the patriarchal narrative of salvationism. The Messiah who sacrificed his life for the world, blah, blah, blah. Now, those of us in the know, and those of you who have read the alternative history of the Grail, know exactly what the Grail is. And I ask you to stop and take a deep breath and put your hand on your heart and look straight ahead as if there was all humanity in front of you. You're looking into the eyes of all humanity and tell them by your look that you actually know what the Grail is. You know. As I've explained, the Grail is many things, and it is also just one thing. And that just one thing is the organic light. So when I came to Belgium originally, I found myself through the chain of friendship and social association introduced into the rarefied world of the Belgian nobility, la noblesse belge. And within that genre, if you will, within that cultural setting, I developed a view of this legend. And I actually talked on the matter of the Grail in Flanders to certain groups of people, aristocrats and members of the Belgian nobility. And what I did not tell them, of course, was that the true meaning of the Grail is that it's not a Christian relic, because they were all totally brainwashed by Christianity and its pathological, toxic variant of Catholicism. I didn't tell them that it's not about a relic, it's not about a chalice, it's about a light. The Grail is the organic light. And so as I was living here in the setting of this legend and working through the versions of the story with my own, let's say, inner and secret knowledge of what the Grail really is, well, being the mythmaker that I am and being the storyteller that I am, it began to evolve a story of what that legend could actually have meant. You know, very often a legend is simply a clue to historical events. and it screens or disguises those events, while at the same time it reveals those events. Now, go investigate the city of Bruges, B-R-U-G-E-S, in central Belgium. It's called Brugge, B-U-R-G-G-E, in Flemish. And you'll find that Bruges is a mysterious city. It is, in fact, a city that floats in a mysterious atmosphere. And it has been called the Venice of the North because it is a city of canals. It's beautiful. Very well preserved, but rather in a Disney-esque fashion, I'm sorry to say. And there is even a church there where supposedly someone reported that the grail as a chalice was actually kept for a certain period of time. There's no real follow-up to that story. There's no real detail anywhere that I found on how it got there. So are you thinking like I'm thinking? Suppose that the legend refers to the true grail. That is, the just one thing that it is. I like that. The just one thing that it is, among the many things that it is. That the organic light and the knowledge of the organic light and those who could deliberately access it represents the grail. And so that knowledge and the people who carried that knowledge came to Flanders, here where I am, went to Bruges sometime in the 12th century. Now, that was a very key moment for the transmission of the Grail and for the diaspora of the pagan mysteries. I have been able to trace the diaspora of the pagan mysteries, as you know, from the death of Hypatia, 415 AD, up directly to the formation of the Knights of the Round Table by the inspiration of the shaman Merlin. And from that time, in the 5th century, through until the 12th century, about 700 years. But I have to tell you that I could not continue writing the alternative history of the Grail from that point onward because I lost track of the Grail. That is to say, I lost track of any historical evidence of those who would have had the direct knowledge of the Grail and access to it according to the method of instruction by the light that was observed in the mysteries. In the 12th century and 13th century, the 1200s onward, there was a massive and murderous reprisal of genocidal violence against anything that retained the values and wisdom of the pagan world. And that violence that was initiated in the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 had a black magical aspect to it. So there was not only a black magical attack upon the guardians of the Grail, the company of the Grail, but there was also a massive political, cultural, ideological, religious, and intellectual assault on anybody who could possibly be an agent of the preservation of the Telestic wisdom and the Telestic method. And that escalated into the 14th and 15th centuries, to the Inquisition, 1,000 years after the death of Hypatia. Torquemada is born. The Inquisition is launched in Spain, in Sevilla, not far from where I live. Believe me, I never go there. And so on into the witch trials. To get some idea of the scope of this assault upon even the meager traces that remained of the Sophianic mystery is extremely difficult for the modern mind. And so I'm proposing now what I contemplated many years ago as I visited Bruges and wandered around its streets and its alleys and walked along its canals and sniffed the atmosphere and looked at the extraordinary light of the lowlands. I share with you now what was, you know, gestating in my soul and imagination at that time. And it is possible that the last knowledge of the Grail and the Telestic method arrived in Bruges around 1200. And at that time, Bruges was at the sea. You see, Bruges is no longer at the sea because the land has been filled in. So now there is a port at the sea called Zeebrugge, and it's a big, ugly port with a lot of transport ships. But previously, there was no Zeebrugge, and there was nothing there except the coast, which came to the limits of Bruges itself. What does that tell you? It tells you that Bruges was a point of departure from Europe toward the north. If, for instance, you had sailed out of Bruges in the 12th or 13th century, you would have sailed into the North Sea. And then you could have gone up into the Baltic Sea from there. You could have gone past the peninsula of Denmark. You could have gone up toward Sweden. And you could have sailed north. Now, I pointed out that the diaspora of the mysteries moved geographically in a direction diametrically opposite to the origin of the Palestinian Redeemer complex, that is to say, the archontic virus introduced to humanity through the vector of the Zadokite cult of the ancient Hebrews. Okay? When it was time for the mystery school teachers and the survivors after Hypatia to leave their native land, they went as far away as possible in the opposite direction from Palestine. And they ended up where? Well, in Wales, in the west lands of England and Ireland and Scotland, but principally in Wales, which is where the Arthurian cult of the Round Table was founded, at a little town near the place called Tintagel. So, let's figure the same scenario, maybe repeating itself. The diaspora of the diaspora of the mysteries, that's what we're talking about now. Yeah, the diaspora of the mysteries at the time of Hypatia's death, 700 years later, you've got the diaspora of the mysteries. And they're being crowded out of Europe and persecuted and driven underground. And where do they want to go? They want to go as far as possible from Rome. Well, unless they go down to Africa, the only other possibility is to go north, isn't it? And if you go directly north from Rome, where do you end up? Finland. And what is Finland next to? Russia. Now, I pick up the thread of the diaspora of the Grail in Russia, as you know. I'll pick it up in Russia about the late 1870s, 1880s, pre-revolutionary Russia. But there is a gap, say, between 1250 and 1850. There's a gap of 600 years. And during that time, there is no historical trace or evidence whatsoever of knowledge of the Grail and the Thelestic method of the mysteries. So this place, Belgium, then, represents perhaps an important juncture in the untold story of the mysteries and of the sacred encounter with the organic light, which is the primary substance body of the wisdom goddess herself. This country and represents a halfway house, perhaps, where the Grail temporarily resided, the guardians of the Grail, until they took their final journey into obscurity and into historical oblivion. So in closing this briefing, I'd like to leave you with that little scenario, half history, half legend, and let it float, if you will, like a pleasant odor in your mind, like a perfumed cloud in your mind. The final thing I might say in closing is that. The Grail legend is the golden thread in history that reveals the continuity of the transmission of the Grail. And today, those of you who enter Planetary Tantra, I place that golden thread in your hands. Now you might wonder if there is any way, from a literary background or by literary historical allusion, to support the little scenario that I just wove. And there most certainly is. And you might even want to make a little investigation of it. The evidence that that scenario regarding Belgium, which at that time would have been known as Lotharingia, I believe, as the halfway house for the guardians of the mysteries before they departed for the far north, eventually to arrive in Russia, can be supported from Wolfram von Eschenbach himself. Go and see what happens in the closing chapters of Parzival. You know, after I've often said this, I was joking once with a princess of Merode, who's a Belgian member of the Belgian nobility, the ancienne princesse de Merode, one of the last members of a very long line of Belgian nobility, who died a couple of years ago. I'm going to joke with her about where is the Grail? Where, and she thought it was a chalice, of course, because she was deeply conditioned by the medieval paradigm of Catholicism, as they all are in that set, you know. And it got to be a heavy subject at moments as I was tutoring her on various guidelines to modern esotericism. And at one point I said, well, I think it's in a pawn shop in Prague, you know. And I actually went to Prague, not with her, but she came to Prague to meet me. And I wandered around Prague with the Princess of Merode and looking for the pawn shop where the Holy Grail was stashed, right? And yet, apart from that kind of joking dismissal of the relic, let's consider the real article, which I suggested to Philippine to be le résonance. I said, the Grail is not a relic, a relique, it's a résonance. And so where is that résonance? What happened to that résonance, which would be, as it were, the clairaudient channeling of the wisdom goddess through the organic light? Well, Wolfram himself tells us what happened. The hero of his story, Parzival, attained the Grail at the Grail Castle. But once he attained it, what did he do? Put it on his mantelpiece as a trophy, eventually to be pawned in Prague? No. Parzival immediately transmitted the Grail. And so the suite of Wolfram's Parzival is that part of the history of humanity that we are writing right now that is transpiring as Anthropos 10 goes down. Game over. As that story, that sick narrative, and all the lies it contains dies in front of your eyes, there arises the legend of the transmission of the Grail. To be in Planetary Tantra is to participate in that story, to be the recipient. Now, what Wolfram says is very interesting. And I'm going to pick up on this in the next talk, the third installment of Where the Nightmare Ends. But just let me leave you with this clue. According to Wolfram, Parzival had one true and great love, Condwirimers. That name means lovely manners or love which conducts behavior. Love conducting behavior. And Condwirimers had a son named Lohengrin. But Parsifal also had a half-brother. His mother, Herzeleide, no, his father, Geumart, he was the only son of Herzeleide, that's the son of the widow. But his father, a knight-errant named Gamaret, had an affair with Queen Belzane in the Far East, that would be Iraq. And so Parsifal had a half-brother named Fearfiz, which name means ferocious or loyal son. Fearfiz, ferocious or loyal son. So Fearfiz was the ferocious or loyal son of the same father as Parsifal, different mother. And additionally, Parsifal had his own son, Lohengrin. Now, both of these figures, these legendary figures, are connected in different ways with the transmission of the Grail, that is to say, the future of the Grail beyond the 12th century, beyond the dawn of the 13th century, and the transmission of the Grail through six or seven centuries of obscurity until it returns to humanity in the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And in the coming talk, number three, I'll pick up on how that transmission can be imagined. I'll sketch out, in some ways, the narrative based on the elements in the story that comes down to the world through Wolfram von Eschenbach.